You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When he was in the Senate, Mike Gravel became nationally known for his attempts in 1971 to end the draft during the Vietnam War and for having put the Pentagon Papers into the public record. A year later, he conducted an unusual campaign for the Democratic nomination for vice president, and in 1973, he played a crucial role in getting congressional approval for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. He was defeated in a bid for a third term in 1980, and then this year he made an unsuccessful run, or two runs, in fact, for a presidential bid, both as a Democrat and as a Libertarian. And he tells his story in an autobiography with the help of investigative journalist Joe Loria called A Political Odyssey, The Rise of American Militarism and One Man's Fight to Stop It. It's published by Seven Stories Press, and I'm delighted that it has brought Mike Gravel and Joe Loria to the show today. Hi. Mike, did you ever worry that speaking your mind might cost you politically? Do you ever look back and say, what was I thinking?
No. When I look back, I just wish in many respects I had been tougher than I was. I felt the peer pressure, which is really the real difficult part of being a senator, because, you know, you're not a member of the club. Your own staff is telling you, well, Senator, please cool it, be more like other senators. And now when I look back and recognize that everything that I did in the first 4 years of my tenure.
But you also must have had the back of your mind the fact that you were elected initially because Ernest Gruening had voted against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. He was being punished for doing something that many people later felt was the right thing to do.
And I felt it was the right thing to do. In point of fact, I wrote him a letter when he voted against Tonkin, congratulating him. If he knew that that letter was in his files, he could have probably exhibited that. When I ran against Ernest, he had really opposed me when I ran for the House 2 years before that, which was very disappointing because I was a protege of his. And so he had turned on me. So I felt that 2 years later, all bets were off. I could run against him. He was in his 80s. I was 38. I felt it was time to change the guard.
Were Alaskans voting for more liberal candidates in those days?
Not necessarily. All I had to do was stand right next to Ernest, and people assumed that I was more to the right than Ernest. What they found out, and which was inured to my not to my benefit, was in point of fact I was every bit as opposed to the war, and in some circles was viewed more liberal than Ernest Gruening was. And I say more liberal. I was always a classic liberal. Ernest was a New Deal liberal, and there's a difference.
Joe, you get equal billing on this book with Mike, which would suggest, because usually in these kinds of books, as told to the other name, is a little smaller.
Yeah.
What role did you play in this to get equal billing?
Mike's laughing. Maybe he could answer that too.
Well, I had to fight. The first iteration of the cover, you needed a magnifying glass to find Joe's name. And Joe, of course, was incensed, but I was equally incensed. He did more work on this book than I did. I mean, I was just a passive. He's just on my case for over a year, and his style of writing was his. I've written a book, but this is his style. And so I was absolutely angry with the publisher. I said, look, this thing goes nowhere unless Joe's name is the same size as my name.
Sure.
So that's why I'm laughing. And so they gave him equal billing, and he deserves equal billing.
So is this really as much your book as it is Mike's?
Well, frankly, when I met Mike in February or March of 2006, we had a breakfast at the Waldorf Astoria. He said to tell me he was going to run for president, and that breakfast turned into lunch. And I realized I was sitting with an American politician with whom I agreed with on virtually everything. So in a sense, it was very easy to me to write this book because my ideas and Mike's are so similar that it was mine and his.
And you're not concerned about repertorial objectivity when you do
something like this? Well, I am. Of course I am. And I think that's why it's very important that this book is not portrayed as just simply a memoir, because it's really only partly that. And that's I use that as a vehicle. We use that as a vehicle to tell the larger story of the history of American military industry and how it's related to government and the expansion of U.S. territory and presidential power as it grew over the years. And that's really the guts of the book. And Mike's life collides. There are two stories, that one and Mike's story. They collide in the 70s when he goes to the Senate.
And many of the themes of that time now seem to be repeating themselves.
Worse. They're not only repeating, they're worse.
Well, in one of the presidential debates this year, you said that the other candidates frightened you. What did you mean by that?
Very simply, because it's politics as usual. They're all tied in to American imperialism. And American imperialism supports the whole concept of the military-industrial complex, the control of our economic society by Wall Street, and all of what that represents. And that is the undoing of our society, which has been totally militarized.
Why do you think that message didn't resonate during the primaries?
Because our culture has been militarized. That's why it didn't resonate. And because mainstream media did not permit it to be. There's another book I have out with a professor at Columbia. It's called The Kingmakers. And that is that mainstream media is the echo chamber of the White House.
But then you switched to the Libertarian Party, and you came in fourth among their candidates. Bob Barr, a very conservative former senator, is the Libertarian candidate. How did the two of you wind up going for the same spot?
Well, first off, I'm very happy that I didn't get the nomination. For the same reason I ran for the Democratic presidential nomination, it was the same one that I ran for the Libertarian. First off, it was easy to go as a Libertarian. I am a classic liberal, one. Two, the Libertarian Party is not a war party. The Democratic Party is a war party. Make no mistake about that. So is the Republican Party. Those two parties control our American society, the polity. They control the government. And they are war parties. And that's, of course, what sustains the military-industrial complex.
Well, you've said the military is the nation's top priority. Don't we need a strong military to protect us from our enemies, especially in this post-9/11 era?
Well, what enemies? I don't know of any enemies. When I was asked in a debate, you know, who are your enemies?
Well, we had the World Trade Towers are gone.
No, that's Al-Qaeda.
What enemies? They're not enemies?
Al-Qaeda's an enemy. Sure, it's a criminal force. So you don't call it a war. When you use the terminology war, this is with that you're able to sustain unlimited funding for a military-industrial complex and a homeland security complex, both of which are unauditable, meaning you don't know where the money goes and you don't know how much you're spending on it. It's a fool's errand. Sure, we need a security, but we spend more on defense than all the rest of the world put together. This is ridiculous.
My guests are former Senator Mike Gravel and Joe Lauria. They've written a book called The Political Odyssey, The Rise of American Militarism and One Man's Fight to Stop It. It has a foreword by Daniel Ellsberg, and it's published by Seven Stories Press. Joe, do you agree with Mike when he says that our leaders have drugged us into a fear-based culture?
I think one of the themes of the book repeatedly is the false threats that government transmitted through media have fed the American people, most formally beginning with the First World War when Wilson created the Creel Committee, which became the basis then for public relations after the war in the civilian sector, in which there were no direct threats to the United States to get into that war, but they sold the war successfully. And we see that especially after the end of the Second World War when the U.S. was left with unprecedented wealth and power in a totally devastated world. There were no threats at that time. The threat that was to the United States was a new depression. The war had gotten the U.S. out of the depression, and there was a great fear that it would start a new one. And in fact, the economy tanked as the demobilization began, which happened after every war. For example, after the Civil War, arm manufacturers made bicycles and sewing machines. After the Second World War, they found that by demobilizing, the economy was tanking. They thought there'd be a new depression. So Truman built up, and I think we've done very well, good job here of proving, that it was all false threats.
Stalin was a false threat?
Yes.
No question about it.
But he got his own atomic bomb and his own hydrogen bomb.
We'll talk about 1948. By 1948, he did not have the bomb. And there were false war scares in the spring of 1948, testimony about Soviet subs off the coast of the United States. Absolute rubbish to get the aircraft industry out of debt, back in the black. And I think the war on terror, the parallels are there, the same thing we've seen, taking threats and exaggerating, manageable threats, exaggerating them for business.
Do you think that everybody's culpable, not just the politicians, but also the media for buying into this?
Very much so, I think.
Totally. And Walter Lippmann led the charge. The great Walter Lippmann led the charge. Dwight Eisenhower, isn't it interesting? The president that had the most military experience at the end of his tenure made the statement that what would be the demise of our democracy. Now, he cast it as a threat that when you had the union of the military and the economic power of the industrialist, it would unite into a military-industrial complex, that's what could possibly destroy our democracy. It is no longer a threat. It has come to pass. They have militarized our culture, and they control our society.
Actually, that left him open to JFK's criticisms of a missile gap with the Soviet
Union. Which did not exist, and it took JFK 2 years to mature, and we saw his maturation come full circle with his speech at American University in June of the year he was assassinated.
Lenin, if I could add that the Soviet Union was totally devastated more than any other country at the end of the Second World War. They were in no way a threat, and even Truman at the very end in his memoir in 1956 admits that it was the tragedy and shame of our time that people actually believed that the communists were going to take over our government, all these fears. He admitted it, so did MacArthur, George Kennan changed, and it was clear that the Soviets were not a threat at that time. It took on, obviously, a power of its own afterwards.
Well, it wasn't just an American thing. Winston Churchill made the famous Iron Curtain speech.
Absolutely. That was a big part of stirring up the fear, unnecessarily.
And you see it right now. When you see the likes of Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, Sam Nunn, Perry and others put in an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal telling us about the threat of nuclear and we got to do something about it. And you see nothing but palliatives. That's all it is. When they're all guilty to bringing us to where we're at, you know, it really begs the question.
So is Barack Obama a war candidate? Isn't he suggesting change?
What change? Tell me about the change he's talking about. He's talking about spending money. I used to say like a drunken sailor, and I was brought up short when somebody said, well, like a drunken Democrat. Every time he turns around, he's talking about we're going to spend $50 billion here, $150 billion there. Hey, the nation is bankrupt.
So you're suggesting we just dismantle the whole military?
No, of course not. I'm not.
Or just keep a small
75% could be cut, and we'd still have much more than Russia or
more
China.
More than we need. Here,
and they're not even our real enemies, as Mike said.
Do the math. Just do the math. If we represent 50% of the world's armament industry, okay, what does China represent? 5%? What does Russia represent? 5%? Britain, 5%? Japan, 4%. France, 5%. We and our allies represent 64% of the world's defense capability. And, quote, Russia and China, 10%. And all Russia is trying to do is become wealthy by supplying energy to Europe and China supplying goods to the United States. And we have 6,000 nuclear devices pointed at who? With human beings that go down in silos that are waiting with a key to get orders from the president to begin Armageddon? Does it get any more insane in our society today that we spend billions and billions of dollars on nuclear stockpiles that don't make any sense and the Russians had the same thing? Hey, the world has gone insane. And our leaders make speeches that don't make any sense to reality.
We have to take a little break. We'll be back with more from former Senator Mike Gravel of Alaska and Joe Loria, co-authors of A Political Odyssey, The Rise of American Militarism, and One Man's Fight to Stop It. It's from Seven Stories Press. We're back with Joe Lauria and Senator Mike Gravel. They've collaborated on a book called Political Odyssey, The Rise of American Militarism and One Man's Fight to Stop It, published by Seven Stories Press. Right now, the Republicans and a few Democrats are calling for more drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Do you, Mike, feel at all responsible as a major advocate for the Alaskan pipeline?
Quite the contrary. At the time of the pipeline, I was an advocate of drilling in the Arctic wildlife range. It's only a small footprint, but I wouldn't lift a finger to help the oil companies drill anywhere. It's stupid. These are energy companies. They have a fair amount of wealth. They're getting all kinds of subsidies from the government, and they don't need those subsidies. What they should do, they're energy experts, and they all have the ability, and they've all been partially involved in solar and wind. And that's where they should expand their efforts, in solar and wind. And we could get off of gasoline in 5 years if we went into a crash program in that regard.
Well, haven't the oil companies made Alaskans rich?
Of course they have.
Lower taxes in the state than anywhere else.
That's right. But oil is a pollutant right now, and we're in our dependency. Isn't it interesting that you have T. Boone Pickens, who is an oil expert and who's made the statement, and bless him, he's made the statement, this is one problem we're not going to drill ourselves out of. But they have these investments in these oil areas, and rather than, the same old story, they want to capitalize on their sunk cost and make profits off of that rather than move into new areas, which is what they should be doing. And that's why I wouldn't help them one iota in these getting more profits out of their sunk costs.
When you announced your candidacy for the presidency, every story included the same thing, Pentagon Papers, Pentagon Papers. Is that what you think will be the first thing they'll mention in your obituary?
I would think so. But then again, there's a few things I'm working on right now, and I think I've got 10 good years left on these tires. And maybe there's a few other things I'll be doing. No, what I hope they'll mention in my obituary is the fact that I want to empower the people to make laws. The answer is not with representative government. That can't change. What can be, and the solution to all the problems we're talking about, is the people, not the leaders in representative government.
You say that as somebody who served in the Senate for two terms?
It doesn't work. If that's not self-evident, Leonard, I don't know what else will be.
You tell a story in the book about how you and Alan Cranston went to a Senate doctor to get colostomy bags so you wouldn't have to leave the Senate floor. That was during a projected filibuster.
Right. Well, it was a little bit of an ego trip. I wanted to beat Strom Thurmond's record of the number of hours. And, of course, in the old days, with Huey Long and others, what they would do is they just flat would pee on the floor of the Senate because you've got to drink a lot of water while you're debating. And so, obviously, I was going to not do something as
vulgar and disgusting.
That's right, as that. But then again, some of these guys were pretty crusty.
Joe, are you as cynical about the role of the legislative branch of government these days?
Oh, yes. How could you not be? I think it's clear.
Do you think that they have ceded that power, or they never really have? The Constitution gives them equal power.
Yes, they had more power at the beginning they were supposed to than the presidency, and that's one of the themes of the book is the rise of the presidential power, and it's linked very much to the arms industry and the growth of American territory. I think what we need to see, and we probably won't, is a period, the one that Mike went into, a very rare period, I think, when 1973, when the militarists who had taken over, we argue, at the end of the Second World War, were defeated in the jungles of Vietnam. That opened up a period of national self-examination. And in the Senate, we had the Church Committee, and we had the House Assassination Committee, and they looked under the rocks and saw what the CIA had done, the new CIA that Truman had created. What had they done with what had the U.S. done with the power it was left with at the end of the Second World War? Did it use it to promote human progress at home and abroad, or simply to multiply that wealth and power? And I think that came to an end in 1980 when Reagan came back. It was a restoration of the militarists. Mike and other Democrats were kicked out. Republicans took back the Senate, and we're still living under that cloud today. They started with a small invasion of Grenada here and a Panama probe there and led all the way up 23 years later to the full-scale Vietnam-sized invasion of Iraq. And that's – we need a period again where the Senate will become predominant in the government and examine what's been happening since 1980.
Well, I remember speaking not so long ago to somebody who had written a book about the growth of presidential power, and it seems that every president, I guess, since FDR has taken on more of that power, and nobody, it would seem to me, who became president would be willing to give any of it back. And isn't that part of the problem as well? There's, you know, once it is given to the president or to the executive, it's going to stay there, and then the next one is going to try to get a little more.
It goes further back than that.
I mean, if you had become president, could you have said, you know, I'm going to just give it all back to the House and the Senate?
No, you can't do that. You're still within the context of representative government. What you want to give back is, and the people never had it, you want to bring the people into the operation of government as an additional check to our system of checks and balances, which fail, the structure fails. And that's where the only answer is to bring the people in. And I have
How do you bring the people in?
I have another book about that. That's called Citizen Power. And people can get it, www.citizen-power.us. And it's simple. Switzerland's the example. There's only one country in the world that has this. We have 24...
But they wouldn't let women vote for years.
I don't say that we change human nature. I'm just saying we bring the people in. I don't have any magic wand to change human nature, but I'll tell you that the people are smarter than their leaders. And it's not individually. It's the majority of the constituency that makes the decision. We have 24 states in this country where people make laws at the state and local level. And we have 100 years of experience, and studies show overwhelmingly that those states are better governed than the states that do not.
But we also hear that one of the big problems in California is that Proposition 13 remains on the books, and that has pretty much made it impossible for education to be improved in the state. I mean,
not so, Leonard. Prop 13 was a butcher's hand because the liberal legislature would not tend to the rise in property values that impacted the elderly in their homes with higher taxes. And so this was the horn of cornucopia for politicians, and they would not, with 10 years of appeals from people being hurt. And so Garn and Jarvis stepped forward. They had no legislative experience and produced a piece of legislation that was not properly crafted, and that set in motion this whole tax area. And people now reacted to that because they know the representative government's not spending their tax dollars wisely.
So you've proposed a national initiative to bring direct democracy to the people?
To bring the people into the operation of government as lawmakers. Here, let's take the words of Cicero. Cicero said to define freedom as participation in power, okay? What is power in a democracy? It is lawmaking. So if the people are really going to participate in power in this country, they have to become lawmakers, but not the way you have it in the 24 states. Making laws is a deliberative process. And so I've spent 10 years crafting this legislation called the National Initiative, and the process to enact it circumvents the entire government. The government will never empower the people. The people have to empower themselves, and we have a process to do that.
My guests are Mike Gravel and Joe Lauria, and they have written a book called Political Odyssey, The Rise of American Militarism and One Man's Fight to Stop It, published by Seven Stories Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How are people going to get back this power? I doubt that anybody who already has power is going to give up any of theirs.
Well, you're so right, Leonard. Of course they're not. The Congress is never going to enact this. The people can enact it.
How can we enact it?
Well, the people are sovereign. The people are sovereign. Here, all of our founding fathers said overwhelmingly that every generation should have the right to make laws.
But these are people who don't go out to vote under normal circumstances.
Well, maybe they're the smart ones. You vote for a Republican one time, nothing happens. You vote for a Democrat, nothing happens. You go back and forth. I might as well stay home and worry about my kids, worry about my job, because here, you're going to vote for Obama this year. You think he's going to bring about
change?
You don't
know I'm going to vote for Obama.
Hey, Obama's going to get elected. I hope he gets elected because I think McCain is a nutcase. But I'll tell you, he'll get elected. He's not going to bring about change. He can't bring about change. All you got to do is follow the money. This is going to be the first billion-dollar presidential election. Follow the money, and if you think there's going to be change, don't hold your breath.
You have anything to add to that, Joe, or should we move on?
No, I think we can move on.
I was wondering, were you covering his presidential campaign from the start?
No, I did one piece for the Boston Globe because I have been a correspondent for them for about 7 years at the UN where they shut down their foreign desk, which is a whole other show you could have on the decimation of foreign reporting in the United States.
Oh, we've already discussed that.
You've done it already, okay.
Any number of times, and we'll continue to continues to be a major issue in this country.
Indeed, indeed. No, I met Mike and I went on my own dime to travel around and do a piece which appeared in The Progressive, and then he suggested this book. And you know, you asked about my independence here. Well, I was very sensitive, and I am about that. So I went back to the archives, his Senate papers. I listened to the oral argument, 4 hours of it in his Supreme Court case. I read all the court papers, interview. I went to Alaska for a week, and I did. Mike didn't remember a lot of things correctly from the past, frankly. He says he's learned things about himself that you never knew, interviewed his family members. And I wanted to do as objective a case. I know with his name on the book, I know that may not appear to be possible, but I think I've done a credible job, and Mike needs a lot of credit for being a politician, a very rare one, a political oddity rather than a political odyssey maybe, to allow that kind of scrutiny.
One of the things that surprised people is that he came out for the nomination 2.5 years before the primaries. That does seem rather early, but was that necessary because he'd been out of the public eye for so long?
Well, I think – go ahead, Mike.
Yes, very much so.
What had you been doing since you left the Senate?
Well, first off, I didn't want to be a public figure. When I left the Senate, I was disgusted with representative government.
Why did you lose? You were an incumbent. Incumbents almost always win.
Oh, no. I was very controversial. I had more scar tissue. I successfully alienated everybody that supported me at one point or another. And what people recall is, what have you done for me lately? And so every constituency that supported me, I alienated. I was a very independent, and plus I didn't want to get reelected. I really didn't. In fact, it was in my mind that had I got reelected, I was going to resign because I had something that I was trying to bring about by having the people become owners of a piece of the Alaska pipeline. But it's a very involved process. But no, and I wanted to go back to private life. My marriage was in trouble, and I was just disgusted.
So you were that rare politician who says, I want to go back and spend some time with my family, who really did want to go back and spend some time with his family?
Well, by that time, I was on my way. My marriage was on the rocks. And I just wanted a private life. But I was a student of public affairs. I was more of a theorist. And then after 10 years, I really landed upon this concept that the answer of human governance lies with the people, not with the leadership. And that's when I developed over a 10-year period this concept of empowering the people.
But, you know, what happens is when you make these kinds of statements, a lot of people just jump on them and say these are wild. I've read news articles, perfectly reasonable news articles, that have dismissed you as part of the loony fringe with a whole bunch of other people. And it's unfair, but it's the way things are done, isn't it?
Well,
Joe, you've been part of that process, haven't you? What happens when you go to an editor and you say, you know, Mike Gravel has something interesting to say here?
I got that piece in the Globe simply because of Mike's performance at the debate that night, and the editor who used to be the foreign editor of the Globe but then took over the campaign editor job said that his son said, I like Mike Gravel, and that's why he ran the piece. So, I mean, it's a funny story, but Mike was a novelty and he did well at that debate. But, of course, he was a long shot and he got a long piece in the Times as well. And unfortunately, what he was saying couldn't be said very well in that 5 minutes that he had on stage. And that's one of the reasons why we did the book as well.
And there's a good chance that he might not have been included at all because in many of these debates, the candidates who are considered marginal are just simply left out. I mean, does that bother you?
But that's a decision. Of course it was. It was grossly unfair. That's the reason why they winnowed it down to two people, Hillary and Obama. And right away, but we caught General Electric red-handed because they're the ones that made the decision to cut me out when I attacked Hillary and the Democratic Party for giving George Bush license to invade Iran with Lieberman II resolution. And how he caught General Electric is that a friend of mine from who was in Delhi, in New Delhi, sent an email to them saying, why have you not let Senator Gravel participate in your debate? Well, they should have sent that to MSNBC, but no, the PR person for General Electric said, well, Senator Gravel didn't meet our criteria. Well, now who the heck was General Electric, a defense contractor, had the right to say that this person, a former senator who has a very distinguished record as a former senator, does not meet their criteria? Excuse me.
So where do you go from here? Are you going to be pushing for more direct democracy?
Oh, I will spend the rest of my life. But secondly, I am in the process of negotiating a syndicated program, a video program, TV program, that will be shown around the world. It will be called Global Analysis Program,
Global Perspectives.
That will be syndicated on six continents, and obviously American television won't be pushing it.
Joe Loria, you're going to be writing more books of this
sort?
I hope
so. No, not with The Politician. I think one time was enough, although we did.
You won't be involved with that?
Not at all, no. No, I'm doing my own separate book proposal on a totally different issue.
But meanwhile, we have this book called A Political Odyssey, The Rise of American Militarism and One Man's Fight to Stop It. It's from Seven Stories Press. My great thanks to Senator Mike Gravel and Joe Loria for being our guests today.
Thank you, Leonard, for having us.
Thank you.